Trade Bites. Trade Bites. The podcast about trade policy. Hello and welcome to another episode of Trade Bites, the podcast series by the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy and hosted by me, Chris Horseman, Deputy Editor of the Trade Policy News Service, Borderlex. Trade Bites is the podcast series that eagerly tears the wrapping off that shiny gift that keeps on giving, that is international trade policy, while making good and sure to keep the gift receipt. And in this episode, we're joined by top pundits who will provide some post-match analysis on that recent fixture over in Abu Dhabi. The 13th Ministerial Conference of the World Trade Organization was held in the UAE capital in the last week of February. MC13, as it's known to its friends, saw trade ministers from the organization's now 166 member countries convene to take key decisions on the regulation of international trade. The problem is that they didn't actually decide on very much. A much-vaunted agreement on controlling international fisheries subsidies was not signed off, and there was the now somewhat traditional punch-up over subsidies to agriculture. So, is the WTO now in a state of crisis? What's the point of an organisation that can't seem to decide on anything much? What needs to change? Or should we perhaps blame the governments who need to make the compromises, without which international agreements can't happen? And what even is an e-commerce moratorium, for goodness sake? Well, with the answers to at least some of these questions, we have an excellent lineup of guests who certainly know their appellate bodies from the SPS committees. I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Anna Perez, lecturer in law at the University of Sussex. It's a pleasure to welcome Dmitry Grozobinski, executive director of the Geneva Trade Platform. And a big welcome too to George Riddell, Trade Strategy Director at EY. Welcome to everyone. Thanks so much for being with us. Dmitry, how would you summarize the outcome of MC13? What got agreed? What got deferred? What got dropped?
Looking at the final outcome, the immediate result is, boy, that meeting could have been an email. But not that much, to be honest, got done. It got a lot closer. It looked like more was going to happen, but it didn't. As you alluded to in your introduction, an e-commerce moratorium was extended for 2 years. This is a global agreement not to charge border taxes on movements of electronic data and products sold electronically across borders. It's considered quite important, both because had it lapsed, that would have been liberalization in the system rolling backwards, but also because a number of countries were flirting with introducing this kind of thing. And while it's not entirely clear how it would work, a lot of companies are really worried about what the compliance costs with something like that would be, and it could have potentially been really disruptive. So it was extended for 2 years, albeit with language that will give its opponents, most notably India and Indonesia, a better tactical position to push against yet another extension 2 years from now when this thing is due to expire. The other piece of good news was two more members joined the WTO, Timor-Leste and Comoros, both completing their accessions negotiations. They are, of course, least developed countries. And on the multilateral front, that really is it for positive development. As you said, an attempt to expand the fisheries subsidies agreement to overfishing, which is the kind of subsidy that is truly depleting fish stocks, didn't end up getting across the line, though it got close. An attempt to expand a COVID-19 waiver on intellectual property to cover therapeutics and diagnostic technologies didn't materialize. India didn't get the legal cover that it wanted for its public stockholding program, whereby it buys food from its farmers and distributes them in violation of WTO rules, and no other progress was made on agriculture. And the attempt to reform the WTO and restore its arbitration function, the appellate body, basically led to an outcome that just said, we agree to keep talking.
Dmitry, that's a great summary. George, who, in broad terms, were the key players at MC13, and who got more or less what they wanted and who didn't?
Great summary from Dimitri on what happened, although I would add one small thing, which is the ministerial declaration, which is effectively the shopping list of everything that the organization's done over the past 2 years and all of the different areas that it's going to agree to keep working on over the coming couple of years, and really reiterating the importance of all of the different topics that WTO has been discussing. That has been quite a lot of work, although it doesn't necessarily lead to a new agreement, does set a bit of a work program for the organization and for different delegations to follow over the coming years until the next ministerial. In terms of the major players, I think this was a really unique ministerial in the sense that we are in the year of elections. If you look at all of the major trading players, whether it's the US and the election in November, the European Union with its election for the parliament in June, or the forthcoming Indian election and Indonesian as well, you have a lot of governments playing to their political base at the moment. And that really did harden positions during the ministerial. And it meant that things which may never have been easy decisions for governments to take wouldn't have been able to in the current context, particularly in the case of agriculture, where we've seen large-scale farmer protests across the world at the moment, but also governments fighting against export restrictions and some other issues as well. So it very much happened in a charged political context, and that drove a lot of the positioning from the major players during the ministerial.
So, Anna, we've talked about the fact that there are a lot of electoral sensitivities in different countries. There weren't very high expectations for MC13 in the run-up to the meeting. Do you think that what was delivered was more or less what you would have expected, or were you disappointed in some way with the outcome?
No, I think it was what was expected at the end. And I understand that having lower expectations may have affected the negotiating mood leading to MC13 and also during the negotiations. But we need to remind ourselves that the WTO does not exist in a vacuum. So from the start, I think there was a clear imbalance between the high level of ambition of the negotiating agenda and the low expectations from pretty much everybody else, all the stakeholders, I would say. So the WTO can only do as much as its members want or can do, or even what they are willing to concede. Not to use my favorite trade jargon, but the WTO is a member-driven organization after all. So we need to remember that. And when governments' interests lie elsewhere because of wars, trade tensions, inward-looking policies, the elections that Georgia mentioned before, that means that very little could be achieved at MC13. So I think what we have now, it's what members could deliver at this point.
Okay, so let's look a bit more closely at the moratorium on digital trade taxes. It was rolled over for 2 years, but if we're to believe the text of the agreement, for only two more years, because it will end in 2026. What do you think are the consequences of that outcome? Are we really going to be heading for a world where there are taxes on downloads of software and streaming of movies? Or is this political posturing on the part of those who claim to be in favor of introducing such tariffs? What do we think?
Is a really important question, and coming to it from a couple of different angles. One is, as Dimitri mentioned, presentation. That this would be the first step backwards that the WTO's ever taken from a guaranteed multilateral trading order that companies can rely on, that they make investment decisions based on, and that would be really thrown into question as a result of the moratorium falling away. There's then the practical question, can countries actually implement a tax of this sort? Now, for a lot of countries, and you know, speaking here in the UK, the EU, US, Australia, Singapore, have already made commitments through their free trade agreements not to impose customs duties on electronic transmissions. So they've already said, we're never going to do this. We've signed up to it in international treaties. Whether that changes at the WTO or not won't change the practice for those countries. And I should note that even though India is against the moratorium in the WTO context, even one of its FTAs has signed up to such commitments not to impose customs duties on electronic transmissions. The one country that currently does have legislation on the books that would allow them to implement this sort of tax is Indonesia. And I think that was definitely present in their objection to the moratorium at the ministerial and their policy positioning around needing more policies baked and also raising revenue as a result. So there is both the presentation and that practical challenge associated with the moratorium.
What would be the real-world implications for the tech industry if the moratorium was to end?
So first of all, it's a loss of certainty. With the moratorium gone, they have to essentially keep an eye out on legislative processes all over the world to see if someone decides to go down this route. I would also add that watching, for example, the European Parliament grapple with tech legislation in areas like privacy and watching what comes out of that process, you can see that legislators aren't necessarily always at the cutting edge of understanding how technology works in a business context and how the interaction of legislation and business will work in a tech context, but that doesn't necessarily stop them implementing legislation, which is why we all have to now click accept on every single website for cookies, even though that necessarily may not have been the wisest idea. So there is a real concern for businesses that governments are going to try this because rhetorically the case for collecting taxes on large foreign corporations, it seems attractive. And the learning curve to discover that it might be impractical, not raise the revenue it's supposed to raise, be easily circumvented, or just be a nightmare in terms of attracting investment and business flows into your country, the learning curve may take some time. So for businesses, it could mean that they face a couple of years of just dealing with a potentially unworkable policy that remains in place until governments arrive at that conclusion.
I think the biggest losers here would be small and medium-sized enterprises and the consumers. So they were the ones who'd have to pay the price for these tariffs.
We've already mentioned that there was no agreement on a plan to introduce new curbs on fisheries subsidies. Before the meeting, it was felt that that was probably one of the best bets for getting a multilateral agreement at MC13. It didn't come together. Why do you think it's so hard to formulate an agreement that would benefit the public commons in this way? Dimitri, in a previous life, you were a trade negotiator. What's your view on this? Is the political economy different in the case of negotiations like this?
It is always easiest to get a WTO agreement on something that the major players have already decided for themselves that they no longer want to do. That's how we got the agreement on agriculture and its limits on certain forms of agricultural subsidies, because the EU and US and other major players had decided to move away from the kind of subsidies it bans. In the fisheries context, we have a situation where a number of the major players that heavily subsidize fishing, frankly, want to continue doing so. And it is very, very difficult to begin from a position where that's the case and attempt to impose limits to change their desire from Geneva, rather than wait until that desire changes in capital and have that shape the outcome. So that is what is going on here. There are very large and heavily subsidized fleets that are fishing in ways that are hurting fish stocks and depleting fish stocks. And the governments that are providing the subsidies that allow this to go on would frankly like to continue doing so. And it is very hard to reconcile that fact with a global agreement that would make it illegal.
One of the things that I think is a real challenge in the fishery subsidies negotiations is the fact that you don't have, beyond many environmental NGOs and other key stakeholders, you don't have a large proponent for the conclusion of these negotiations. So unlike in the case of, you know, reducing tariffs on industrial products or lowering barriers in services trade, where there are wider constituencies who really engage in these WTO negotiations, fisheries subsidies is a really difficult one because you lack that wider community and stakeholder buy-in as a result.
I just wanted to add that what we understand by international trade today is not the same as it was in 1995. And I think that's the biggest challenge when we are talking about fisheries or environmental issues or behind the border measures in general. So the normative framework of the multilateral trade regime is changing. So when the WTO was created, the main goal in international trade was to secure market access through shallow integration. And such rationale was relatively successful during the Uruguay round, but it doesn't stand today. So we have all of these broad issues that affect trade and are impacted by international trade. So that means that the development of international trade relations claims for regulation in areas that were previously exclusively regulated by domestic policies and that are politically sensitive. So I think that's where lies the importance of bringing the discussions in Geneva closer to domestic constituents.
And I guess a related point is the European Union's push. They were particularly keen on the idea of starting talks on industrial subsidies. So talks to give grants, startup assistance to companies who are producing electric vehicles and so on. But that didn't really get off the ground either. What are your views on how likely it is that we will see WTO negotiations in this area at some point in the next few years?
I think it's inevitable because I think it's the current trend and it's going to only continue. So we have new countries assessing the possibility of implementing industrial policies. So I think that's going to happen in the WTO. I think it's more difficult to happen in a ministerial conference than in the day-to-day works of the WTO. I think it's important also to remember that the ministerial conference is only the tip of the iceberg of WTO negotiations. So we have all of this work happening in the background, in the day-to-day committees and meetings, and I think that's the best place for these discussions.
Industrial subsidies, and particularly as it relates to sort of how do we promote a transition to a more sustainable economy, is going to be one of the major questions I think that the WTO and its membership have to grapple with over the coming years. Certainly in the recent past, we've seen a massive expansion in these types of subsidy programs from China, the EU, US. But we need to remember that not all countries can afford these types of industrial subsidies. And I think that it's not just about having that discussion that the EU wants to have around how does that get incorporated into the WTO's work, but also the pushback that we'll see from other countries who want to limit the trade distorting effects that these types of industrial policy programs will inevitably have on their own economies as they seek to, you know, build up more green industries domestically. So it's going to be part of the push and pull of the organization's work, I think.
Now, in all of the reports about the disagreements at MC13, one name always seemed to crop up, and that's India. What is it with India and the WTO? Why do they seem to relish this role of being the enfant terrible of international trade politics? And what do they actually want out of WTO membership? Just wonder what your views are on that.
It's easy to use pejorative language, and there's a lot of frustration with India. Ultimately, they're advancing their interests as they perceive them, same as all other members. This kind of, oh, they're spoilers. Well, they have a position, they're advancing it. That's what they're supposed to do as members. I will say a couple of things. First of all, the WTO routinely makes front page news in India in a way it does not make front page news in any of our countries. I think if the WTO were routinely on the front pages of the UK papers, of the US papers, I suspect our politics towards it and our performance in it would also be shaped by that. Secondly, one of the signature policies of the Modi government, which is the public stockholding program, whereby, as I said, it buys food from its farmers and distributes it, puts it in violation of WTO rules. If an absolutely core signature policy of our government were for a decade putting it in breach of WTO rules, and that's potentially facing a dispute, you can imagine that shaping our politics as well. And thirdly, India believes or attempts to position itself and has for a long time as a champion of developing countries, the global south, whatever nomenclature you want to use within the WTO. That is not an uncontested self-designation. And in fact, at this ministerial, we saw perhaps the sharpest examples of Indian positions running contrary to positions of, for example, the African Caribbean Pacific Group, which represents far more developing countries than just India, where they were saying opposite things in areas like e-commerce. But India sees itself and positions itself rhetorically and domestically politically as fighting against an unjust system dominated by rich Western countries. And that formulation works very well for it, to the point where coming back to Delhi for an Indian commerce minister and saying, we prevented outcomes, is a positive news story in a lot of ways, because they can say the implicit assumption is that whatever the outcomes were going to be negative for the global south, because they would have been dictated by the global north. So it is politically an attractive prospect for them. They have a burning interest. And it's a positioning matter geopolitically that's far broader than just the WTO.
Just to add on to that, I think it was really interesting, one of the comments that the Indian Commerce Minister Piyush Goyal made following the ministerial meeting, which was that we do not have any offensive interests at the moment in the WTO. That is really a defining statement in terms of how they're willing to advocate for outcomes in these ministerial meeting negotiations. I think it's also important to look at India's position vis-a-vis other WTO members. India was one of the original signatories under the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. Relatively speaking to the other BRICS, it has very lenient WTO commitments. Their tariff bindings are higher. They have lower numbers of services market access commitments, particularly compared with China. And if a big multilateral round of negotiations were to be concluded, India's negotiating leverage would drop as a result, because their commitments would have to approximate other WTO members of a similar level of development. So they actually have some interest in protecting that current negotiating space that they have.
The divides in the WTO are often depicted as being the global south versus the developed countries of the world, but it's sounding like that's a little bit too much of an oversimplification. I just wonder where you think the fault lines lie, and can anything be done about it to make decision-making in the WTO more smooth and less traumatic?
I think the division now is much more insiders versus outsiders than developing versus developed countries. So those who are in the meetings, those who have tools to impose their agenda there to protect their interests. And usually the outsiders are those LDCs or smaller developing countries. But I think what it needs to be done is to bring them to the table, to give them procedural power. You were talking about India, and you can see that India was important in the early 2000s when we had the three G20, India, Brazil, Indonesia, later on China. The role of those countries were really important to protect agriculture and to protect the interests of developing countries. What we have now is even the relationship between India and Brazil. You can see that those countries, they grew apart, and we cannot find a bridge. You cannot find the common ground. And I think that's the main problem, because smaller developing countries, LDCs, they need coalitions. They need to have help or assistance with human resources. They need research to feed into their negotiating position. So I think this sense of cooperation that coalitions, interest groups could give is essential for the outsiders of the negotiations.
Obviously, more inclusion of LDCs and smaller developing countries would be great, but I don't think I agree with Anna that that's where the fault line lies or that's the primary problem. The fundamental issue is that you have a number of players with a strong incentive to block forward momentum, as George explained. You have a US that built the system in part by trading access to its market for systemic shaping, that is no longer willing to do so and is no longer willing to twist arms the way it used to. when the agreement on trade facilitation's implementation got stuck for a year because India held it up. It was ultimately a phone call from Obama to Modi that pushed that over that last little hurdle. The US, it's fairly clear, is no longer willing to expend that kind of political capital to overcome that kind of impasse. And more fundamentally, I think we have a situation where countries are no longer as convinced of the WTO's core premise that liberalization and rules and stability trumps the flexibility the policy space provides. And we are entering into a period defined by geopolitics and environmental concerns, where governments do not know what kind of trade-impacting policies they might want to have 5 years from now, and thus have very little appetite to negotiate rules that would tie their hands in ways that they might want to waive them.
And that brings us on to the question of decision-making within the WTO. It operates on the basis of unanimity. Everything has to be agreed by consensus. How feasible is that now for an organization which now counts 166 members? And are there viable alternative options for getting things done?
Throughout this conversation, we've been really focused on the multilateral outcomes from MC13 and around what was happening in the margins of the ministerial conference. And I think this is actually where some of the most exciting developments happened. There were large coalitions of WTO members around trade and environment moving forward that agenda around micro, small, and medium-sized enterprises, trade and gender, services, domestic regulation, which is one of the plurilateral initiatives that was agreed a couple of years ago. India and South Africa formally withdrew their objections to the entry into force of that agreement through the services schedules on an MFN basis. And then also we saw the conclusion and publishing of the Investment Facilitation for Development plurilateral initiative. Now, I think the difference in response to your question between that services domestic regulation discussion, which is about integrating additional commitments by those WTO members that want to through their existing legal architecture, so through the services schedules that exist in the WTO, while that has been a fractious process of getting those schedules rectified, that has now been resolved. What hasn't been resolved is the formal request by the Investment Facilitation for Development Agreement to be formally adopted by the WTO as what's called an Annex 4 agreement that requires all that unanimity point that you mentioned by all WTO members to incorporate it into the legal architecture. So definitely, in my view, that those plurilateral initiatives are the future of the organization. It's where we're seeing the most progress. It's where we're seeing really engaged WTO members getting involved. But that outstanding question of how to integrate it into the system, I think, will remain contentious for the foreseeable future.
So what we're saying is that these coalitions of the willing are the way to get things done in the WTO, but what they finally agree can only be ratified by the WTO if everybody agrees, which is a bit of a catch-22. Anna, what's your view?
Yes, I agree with George. I think plurilaterals, even if you don't have a formal outcome yet for investment facilitation, for example, just a discussion over critical mass, open plurilaterals, the exercise of trying to find creative solutions to integrate these rules into the WTO rule book, I think that's really important and really significant for the WTO because members, they don't want to give up consensus. So I think that's the main issue. It's problematic to have consensus now 166 countries. But at the same time, they don't want to give up this political power they have in the WTO because that adds to the legitimacy of the organization, of the decision-making process. And that could have repercussions, could make the dispute settlement even weaker or the trade policy review as well. So they want to keep this consensus. So the Marrakesh Agreement is quite, I think, flexible in that sense because it allows members to use their creativity to try to come up with different negotiating tools or these informal meetings and informal processes to keep negotiating new rules.
So as we move towards the close of our podcast, there's one question that I'd like to put to all three of you, if I may. Moving forward a couple of years in time to MC14, the next ministerial conference, which is due to take place in 2026 in Cameroon. What do we think would need to happen for that meeting to be classed as a success. What needs to happen? What do you think will actually happen at the outcome of that meeting? We're obviously projecting ourselves a long way forward here, but what are your crystal balls telling you? George, perhaps I could come to you first.
I'm going to be fascinated to hear what the others say. I think from my perspective, a lot depends on what happens this year with regards to the different elections around the world. We have heard some leading Republican front runners in the US talk about withdrawing from the WTO or at least minimizing the US's presence in the organization. If that were to happen, simply the WTO continuing to exist and function in some way in 2026, I think could be regarded as a resounding success. Outside of that, I definitely think making more progress on the trade and environmental discussion that's currently underway in the organization is an absolute priority, given some of the pressures of climate change and also those industrial subsidy questions that we were talking about earlier. Advancing those is, to my mind, one of the biggest priorities for the organization.
Anna, what's your view?
I think that the outcomes of MC13 says more about the present of the WTO than the future. So my focus would be on these 2 years leading to MC14. I mentioned before the huge amount of work happening, the day-to-day activities of committees and meetings in the WTO, and I think that should be the focus. That work is more essential than ever for the WTO now. So I think the focus should be on the routine and negotiating process in the WTO to overcome these political divergences that we've been talking about here for the past half an hour, and try to take this pragmatic turn to address the needs of governments and the needs of the global economy. So, of course, we need to have a permanent solution for the appellate body. We need to deal with fisheries, environmental issues, e-commerce, investment facilitation, subsidies, industrial policies in general. So I think to do everything in a ministerial conference, it's quite ambitious and unrealistic. So that's why we need the day-to-day work of the WTO.
Dimitri, the agenda is a long one. How much do you think will and could be achieved by the time the ministers meet again in 2 years?
I'm a skeptic on the negotiating function at the moment. I think MC13, as close as it came, revealed that there just isn't a lot of appetite for consensus at the moment. I think Anna is 100% right, and kind of building on what George was saying, in the intervening 2 years, it's up to the members to demonstrate that they can use this organization and its day-to-day function to begin talking about some of these environmental policies and the frictions between them. That would be a reinvestment in the core work. But fundamentally, I think MC14, to an extent like MC13 and 12, will be a continued rearguard action where we attempt to preserve the quite ambitious level of secured liberalization in the face of a world that is increasingly skeptical about its limits. So just having ministers come together and say, no, fundamentally, we still agree on this. We've got no appetite or consensus for a bold suite of new rules, but we're going to do some things among ourselves plurilaterally. We're going to keep using the systems, and we still fundamentally agree that rules and predictability is better than the alternative, would be a success, albeit one that is grading on a fairly steep curve.
That is a realistic, I think, assessment of where we've got to, and also a recognition that without the WTO, the first thing we would need to do is invent something which was pretty much identical to it in order to keep the status quo going in terms of the rules which underpin the global trading system. But there we have to wrap up our podcast today. I'm very, very grateful indeed to my guests for their excellent contributions, to Dr. Anna Perez, to Dimitri Grozovinski, and to George Riddell. And of course, last but by no means least, thanks to all of you for tuning in and listening. Do catch us again next time for the next episode of Trade Bites. Trade Bites is brought to you by the Center for Inclusive Trade Policy, supported by the Economic and Social Research Council.